Chapter 25. Persons present. Macaulay began with the senior wrangler of 1801, 234, and so on, giving the name of each, and relating his subsequent career and rise. Every man who has known him has his story regarding that astonishing memory. It may be that he was not ill-pleased that you should recognize it, but to those prodigious intellectual feats, which were so easy to him, who would grudge his tribute of homage? His talk was, in a word, admirable, and we admired it. Of the notices which have appeared regarding Lord Macaulay, up to the day when the present lines are written, the 9th of January, the reader should not deny himself the pleasure of looking especially at two. It is a good sign of the times, when such articles as these, I mean the articles in the Times and Saturday Review, appear in our public prints about our public men. They educate us, as it were, to admire rightly. An uninstructed person in a museum, or at a concert, may pass by without recognizing a picture or a passage of music, which the connoisseur by his side may show him as a masterpiece of harmony, or a wonder of artistic skill. After reading these papers you like, and respect more the person you have admired so much already. And so with regard to Macaulay's style there may be faults, of course, what critic can't point them out? But for the nonce we are not talking about faults. We want to say nil nisi bonum. Well, take at hazard any 3 pages of the Caesar history, and, glimmering below the stream of the narrative, as it were, you, an average reader, see 1, 2, 3, a half score of allusions to other historic facts, characters, literature, poetry, with which you are acquainted. Why is this epithet used? Whence is that simile drawn? How does he manage, in 2 or 3 words, to paint an individual, or to indicate a landscape? Your neighbor, who has his reading, and his little stock of literature stowed away in his mind, shall detect more points, allusions, happy touches, indicating not only the prodigious memory and vast learning of this master, but the wonderful industry, the honest, humble previous toil of this great scholar. He reads 20 books to write a sentence. He travels 100 miles to make a line of description. Many Londoners, not all, have seen the British Museum Library. I speak a Kier Albert, and pray the kindly reader to bear with me. I have seen all sorts of domes of Peter's and Paul's, Sophia, Pantheon, what not, and have been struck by none of them, so much as by that Catholic dome in Bloomsbury, under which our 1,000,000 volumes are housed. What peace, what love, what truth, what beauty, what happiness for all, what generous kindness for you and me, are here spread out. It seems to me one cannot sit down in that place without a heart full of grateful reverence. I own to have said my grace at the table, and to have thanked heaven for this my English birthright, freely to partake of these bountiful books, and to speak the truth I find there. Under the dome which held Macaulay's brain, and from which his solemn eyes looked out on the world, but a fortnight since, what a vast, brilliant, and wonderful store of learning was ranged! What strange lore would he not fetch for you at your bidding? A volume of law, or history, a book of poetry familiar or forgotten except by himself who forgot nothing, a novel ever so old, and he had it at hand. I spoke to him once about Clarissa. Odd read Clarissa. He cried out, "If you have once thoroughly entered on Clarissa, and are infected by it, you can't leave it." When I was in India I passed one hot season at the hills, and there were the Governor General, and the Secretary of Government, and the Commander in Chief, and their wives. I had Clarissa with me. And, as soon as they began to read, the whole station was in a passion of excitement about Miss Harlow and her misfortunes, and her scoundrelly Lovelace. The governor's wife seized the book, and the secretary waited for it, and the chief justice could not read it for tears. He acted the whole scene. He paced up and down the Athenaeum library. I dare say he could have spoken pages of the book of that book, and of what countless piles of others. In this little paper, let us keep to the text of Nil Nisi Bonum. One paper I have read regarding Lord Macaulay says he had no heart. Why, a man's books may not always speak the truth, but they speak his mind in spite of himself. And it seems to me this man's heart is beating through every page he penned. He is always in a storm of revolt and indignation against wrong, craft, tyranny. How he cheers heroic resistance. How he backs and applauds freedom struggling for its own. How he hates scoundrels, ever so victorious and successful. How he recognizes genius, though selfish villains possess it. The critic who says Macaulay had no heart might say that Johnson had none. And two men more generous, and more loving, and more hating, and more partial, and more noble, do not live in our history. Those who knew Lord Macaulay knew how admirably tender and generous, asterisk and affectionate he was. It was not his business to bring his family before the theater footlights, and call for bouquets from the gallery as he wept over them. Asterisk since the above was written, I have been informed that it has been found, on examining Lord Macaulay's papers, that he was in the habit of giving away more than a fourth part of his annual income. If any young man of letters reads this little sermon and to him, indeed, it is addressed, I would say to him, bear Scott's words in your mind, and be good, my dear. Apostrophe here are two literary men gone to their account, and, los Dio, as far as we know, it is fair, and open, and clean. Here is no need of apologies for shortcomings, or explanations of vices which would have been virtues, but for unavoidable and see here are two examples of men most differently gifted. Each pursuing his calling, each speaking his truth as God bade him, each honest in his life. Just and irreproachable in his dealings, dear to his friends, honored by his country, beloved at his fireside. It has been the fortunate lot of both to give incalculable happiness and delight to the world, which thanks them in return with an immense kindliness, respect, affection. It may not be our chance, brother scribe, to be endowed with such merit, or rewarded with such fame. But the rewards of these men are rewards paid to our service. We may not win the baton or epaulettes, but God give us strength to guard the honor of the flag. On half a loaf. A letter to MESSRS. Broadway, Battery & Co. of New York, bankers. Is it all over? May we lock up the case of instruments? Have we signed our wills, settled up our affairs? Pretended to talk and rattle quite cheerfully to the women at dinner so that they should not be alarmed, sneaked away under some pretext, and looked at the children sleeping in their beds with their little unconscious thumbs in their mouths and a flush on the soft pillowed cheek, made every arrangement with Colonel McTurk, who acts as our second and knows the other principal a great deal too well to think he will ever give in. Invented a monstrous figment about going to shoot pheasants with Mac in the morning, so as to soothe the anxious fears of the dear mistress of the house, early as the hour appointed for the little affair was. Have we been awake hours and hours sooner, risen before daylight, with a faint hope, perhaps, that McTurk might have come to some arrangement with the other side? At 7 o'clock, confound his punctuality. Heard his cab wheel at the door, and let him in looking perfectly trim, fresh, jolly, and well-shaved. Driven off with him in the cold morning, after a very unsatisfactory breakfast of coffee, and stale bread and butter which choke, somehow, in the swallowing. Driven off to Wormwood Scrubs in the cold, muddy, misty, moonshiny morning. Stepped out of the cab, where Mac has bid the man, to halt on a retired spot in the common. In 1 minute more, seen another cab arrive, from which descend two gentlemen, one of whom has a case like McTurk's under his arm, looked round and round the solitude, and seen not one single sign of a policeman, no more than in a row in London, deprecated the horrible necessity which drives civilized men to the use of powder and bullet. Taken ground as firmly as may be, and looked on, whilst Mac is neatly loading his weapons, and when all ready, and one looked for the decisive one, two, three, have we even heard Captain O'Toole, the second of the other principal, walk up, and say, Colonel McTurk, I am desired by my principal to declare at this 11th, this 12th hour, that he is willing to own, that he sees he has been wrong in the dispute which has arisen between him and your friend, that he apologizes for offensive expressions which he has used in the heat of the quarrel, and regrets the course he has taken. If something like this has happened to you, however great your courage, you have been glad not to fight. However accurate your aim, you have been pleased not to fire. On the 6th day of January in this year 62, what hundreds of thousands, I may say, what millions of Englishmen, were in the position of the personage here sketched Christian men, I hope, shocked at the dreadful necessity of battle. Aware of the horrors which the conflict must produce, and yet feeling that the moment was come, and that there was no arbitrament left, but that of steel and cannon. My reader, perhaps, has been in America. If he has, he knows what good people are to be found there, how polished, how generous, how gentle, how courteous. But it is not the voices of these you hear in the roar of hate, defiance, folly, falsehood, which comes to us across the Atlantic. You can't hear gentle voices. Very many who could speak are afraid. Men must go forward, or be crushed by the maddened crowd behind them. I suppose after the perpetration of that act, of what shall we call it? Of sudden war, which Wilkes did, and Everett approved, most of us believed that battle was inevitable. Who has not read the American papers for 6 weeks past? Did you ever think the United States government would give up those commissioners? I never did, for my part. It seems to me the United States government have done the most courageous act of the war. Before that act was done, what an excitement prevailed in London. In every club there was a parliament sitting in permanence. In every domestic gathering this subject was sure to form a main part of the talk. Of course I have seen many people who have traveled in America, and heard them on this matter friends of the South, friends of the North, friends of peace, and American stockholders in plenty. Hay will never give up the men, sir, that was the opinion on all sides, and, if they would not, we knew what was to happen. For weeks past this nightmare of war has been riding us. The city was already gloomy enough. When a great domestic grief and misfortune visits the chief person of the state, the heart of the people too, is sad and awe-stricken. It might be this sorrow and trial were but presages of greater trials and sorrow to come. What if the sorrow of war is to be added to the other calamity? Such forebodings have formed the theme of many a man's talk, and darkened many a fireside. Then came the rapid orders for ships to arm, and troops to depart. How many of us have had to say farewell to friends whom duty called away with their regiments, on whom we strove to look cheerfully, as we shook their hands, it might be for the last time, and whom our thoughts depicted, treading the snows of the immense Canadian frontier, where their intrepid little band might have to face the assaults of other enemies than winter and rough weather. I went to a play one night, and protest I hardly know what was the entertainment which passed before my eyes. In the next stall was an American gentleman, who knew me. Good heavens, sir, I thought, is it decreed that you and I are to be authorized to murder each other next week? That my people shall be bombarding your cities, destroying your navies, making a hideous desolation of your coast, that our peaceful frontier shall be subject to fire, rapine, and murder? Hay will never give up the men, said the Englishman. Hay will never give up the men, said the American. And the Christmas piece which the actors were playing proceeded like a piece in a dream. To make the grand comic performance doubly comic, my neighbor presently informed me how one of the best friends I had in America, the most hospitable, kindly, amiable of men, from whom I had twice received the warmest welcome, and the most delightful hospitality, was a prisoner in Fort Warren, on charges by which his life perhaps might be risked. I think that was the most dismal Christmas fun which these eyes ever looked on. Carry out that notion a little farther, and depict 10,000, 100,000 homes in England saddened by the thought of the coming calamity, and oppressed by the pervading gloom. My next door neighbor perhaps has parted with her son. Now the ship in which he is, with 1,000 brave comrades, is plowing through the stormy midnight ocean. Presently under the flag we know of, the thin red line in which her boy forms a speck, is winding its way through the vast Canadian snows. Another neighbor's boy is not gone, but is expecting orders to sail, and someone else, besides the circle at home maybe, is in prayer and terror, thinking of the summons which calls the young sailor away. By firesides modest and splendid, all over the three kingdoms, that sorrow is keeping watch, and myriads of hearts beating with that thought, will they give up the men? I don't know how, on the first day after the capture of the Southern Commissioners was announced, a rumor got abroad in London, that the taking of the men, was an act according to law, of which our nation could take no notice. It was said, that the law authorities had so declared, and a very noble testimony to the loyalty of Englishmen, I think, was shown by the instant submission of high-spirited gentlemen, most keenly feeling that the nation had been subject to a coarse outrage, who were silent when told that the law was with the aggressor. The relief which presently came, when, after a pause of a day, we found that law was on our side, was indescribable. The nation might then take notice of this insult to its honor. Never were people more eager than ours, when they found they had a right to reparation. I have talked during the last week with many English holders of American securities, who, of course, have been aware of the threat held over them. Gland, says the New York Herald, cannot afford to go to war with us, for 600 millions worth of American stock is owned by British subjects, which, in event of hostilities, would be confiscated. And we now call upon the companies not to take it off their hands on any terms. Let its forfeiture be held over England as a weapon in terrorem. British subjects have 200 or 300 millions of dollars invested in shipping and other property in the United States. All this property, together with the stocks, would be seized, amounting to 900 millions of dollars. Will England incur this tremendous loss for a mere abstraction? Whether mere abstraction here means the abstraction of the two Southern commissioners from under our flag, or the abstract idea of injured honor, which seems ridiculous to the Herald, is it needless to ask? I have spoken with many men who have money invested in the States, but I declare I have not met one English gentleman whom the publication of this threat has influenced for a moment. Our people have 900 millions of dollars invested in the United States, have they? And the Herald calls upon the companies not to take any of this debt off our hands. Let us, on our side, entreat the English press to give this announcement every publicity. Let us do everything in our power to make this all upon the Americans well known in England. I hope English newspaper editors will print it, and print it again and again. It is not we who say this of American citizens, but American citizens who say this of themselves. All is odious. We can't bear Bull. He is haughty, arrogant, a braggart, and a blusterer. And we can't bear brag and bluster in our modest and decorous country. We hate Bull, and if he quarrels with us on a point in which we are in the wrong, we have goods of his in our custody, and we will rob him. Suppose your London banker saying to you, "Sir, I have always thought your manners disgusting, and your arrogance insupportable. You dare to complain of my conduct, because I have wrongfully imprisoned Jones. My answer to your vulgar interference is, that I confiscate your balance." What would be an English merchant's character after a few such transactions? It is not improbable that the moralists of the Herald would call him a rascal. Why have the United States been paying 7, 8, 10% for money for years past, when the same commodity can be got elsewhere at half that rate of interest? Why, because though among the richest proprietors in the world, creditors were not sure of them. So the states have had to pay 80 millions yearly for the use of money which would cost other borrowers but 30. Add up this item of extra interest alone for a dozen years, and see what a prodigious penalty the states have been paying for repudiation here and there, for sharp practice, for doubtful credit. Suppose the peace is kept between us, the remembrance of this last threat alone will cost the states millions and millions more. If they must have money, we must have a greater interest to ensure our jeopardized capital. Do American companies want to borrow money as want to borrow they will? Mr. Brown, show the gentleman that extract from the New York Herald which declares that the United States will confiscate private property in the event of a war. As the country newspapers say, please, country papers, copy this paragraph. And, gentlemen in America, when the honor of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.